this might be the first Godot Fest, but has any one of you attended the Godot Con in 2023 here in Munich? Then you might know that the game Domekeeper was already around back then, but it was a single-player game. That has changed. All to Chris Reidenauer, who will present you how it was to transform a complex existing single-player game into a multiplayer one. Please listen to Chris Reidenauer.
Hello, thank you. My name is Chris Reidenauer, the founder at KAR Games. We're a small studio, runs Godot. We're in Cincinnati, Ohio. We first released our first multiplayer game, Drift Space Survival, in early access in 2023. We were recently in this year's Godot showreel as we kind of work towards 1.0. So I spend a lot of time thinking about network game systems, and I spend even more time being covered in children. So a lot of you do know about Domekeeper. If you saw Renee's talk yesterday, you know that it was previously Dome Romantique. It built during Ludum Dare in 72 hours. You probably know that you defend yourself against waves of monsters, dig for resources, and upgrade your base to survive. They've launched 10 free updates since launching originally in September 2022. And more importantly, it's 62,000 lines of GD script when we started this port. So while it might seem simple on the surface, it's actually a lot of deep, complex systems that make it the great game that it is. So a lot of times when you have a single-player game that people like, one of the most requested features, if you could just add multiplayer, as if there was just a button that you could just click and make that happen. And sometimes this comes across in a lot of ways from your players. So I searched the Bip and Bits Discord for people talking about multiplayer and co-op. And it was really easy to find just so many different ways that people were constantly thinking about this. Though I think my favorite one, they really kind of succinctly said it, multiplayer when, you know. And they weren't the only ones thinking about it. Actually, even before release, you know, the team was thinking about co-op, thinking about how multiplayer could make this game even better, thinking about how it could impact the design and the balance, and playing around a lot with local multiplayer at the time. So how do you start? How do you take these 62,000 lines of code that were really written with single player in mind and actually transform it into a multiplayer experience? What does that even look like? So when we first started our conversations, we had to decide what version of multiplayer we were looking for, because it can come in a lot of different ways. First off, was this local or online? Because those can be very different. Local, you know, I like to think about multiplayer as two computers when you're online, two computers simulating this magic world that you have. But they have to have enough data so they simulate it in the exact same way. With local, you can bypass a lot of that. Not to say that it's easy, but it's much easier than online. Is this competitive or friendly? Because that can make a huge impact on how you actually structure the whole thing and whether you can kind of trust the people you're playing with. How many players are there? Obviously minimum two, but going beyond that can have a lot of different implications. Are public lobbies, or do you have, you know, can you play with just about anyone? Or are you having to invite friends? And are we adding multiplayer to the existing game modes? Or is this some sort of special multiplayer experience that we're shipping alongside the game? And the last one is, and a lot of people kind of forget about this, is multiplayer something you have to decide at the beginning, or can you decide maybe middle of the way through the match, and how can that impact everything going on? So local or online multiplayer. So as we talked about, local is orders of magnitude easier to develop. You don't have to actually simulate the world on two computers, you can just add more players to the existing world. And if you do local multiplayer, you can use things like Steam Remote Play Together to allow them to actually play online as if they're on the same computer. But this does have a drawback. There's no equivalent for consoles, and there's no equivalent for cross-play. So if you have those ambitions, that could be harder. If you go online only, it kind of eliminates couch co-op, which can be important for consoles and was just a strong motivation for the team. I know Bip and Bits wanted to sit down and play together, and that was the original ambition. But in theory, you should be able to mix both, but it can be more complex. Competitive or friendly? Or are we concerned about cheaters? And honestly, this is one of the biggest decisions you can make and can change the scope of your project entirely. The real question is, can we trust the data that we receive from the people we're playing with? Or do we need, the only way to combat that is have a fleet of servers who are the source of truth. You can't rely on one player to be the host. If they're simulating the game, well, then you constantly have costs and you have DevOps and things like that. And so that can be a real make or break. But some games just are only fun in a competitive way, and some games are fun co-op. Choosing how many players you have. Think about the data structures in your game. You probably need to change some just to go from one to many. But even some can have more implications as you go beyond two. And sometimes you might just want to have a data structure that says player one and player two. You may not want to make that full one-to-many transition. Sometimes you can have what we call a little sibling mode. So you just give a way for someone else to interact with your game, to be part of that game, be part of that experience. Again, it doesn't have to be the full co-op and magic dream that a lot of people are asking for to bring that to life. And as you go beyond two people, if you are playing peer-to-peer, that puts more stress on the host to talk about the whole game state to everyone who's playing. So public lobbies or invite only. So who are these people you're actually going to play with? So do you have to deal with jerks on the internet or just my jerk friends? You know, so if you have a friend who's going to cheat in a co-op game, like, okay, that's fine. That's not our problem. But if you add public lobbies, and you have any sort of like competitive like mode, even if it's not like a competitive leaderboard system, it can kind of change a community in a way. But if we don't have public lobbies, how are we allowing maybe like my Steam player to play with my Xbox player? So that can create some additional challenges there. So thinking about the game modes, are we just adding player two or player four to the existing game modes, and how is that going to impact the game design and balance? Or do we want to create all new game modes that are focused on multiplayer and have different challenges? And what are the rules when more players are present? Do things get harder? Do things stay the same? How does that impact leaderboards? These are sort of things you have to think about when you're approaching this. And so the last one, joining mid-match. So if you think about how, you know, each world is simulating your new world that you created, what happens if someone comes in the middle? What if I want to join someone who's halfway through a game? How do I get them enough data so that they can catch up and act like they're right in the middle of the game? You know, can they catch up? Can we provide enough state for that to happen? For Domekeeper, we thought about this a lot, and we realized the issues would more come during combat than mining phase. So combat's a lot more high speed, a lot more things happening, a lot more things moving. So we talked about potentially limiting it to the mining phase. But, you know, as things go, we'll see how it shapes out. So going back to our list of goals, for Domekeeper specifically, we decided local or online, let's just do both. We have different, you know, different scales. We have a different team, but it may not be the right answer for you. Competitive or friendly? We decided friendly. This was the dream, was to play with our friends. We wanted to bring our friends into this game. Weren't trying to create a competitive atmosphere. How many players? So some game modes, it made sense to have two. Some it had four. But as we were playtesting, we kind of just left it open-ended on the top end. And we realized that we have like 7-8 people. It's chaotic, but it's like really good chaos. And so if you have the like a host who can handle that, it's a lot of fun, and we want to invite you to try that out yourself. We did invite-only lobbies. Again, we just want to make sure that you're playing with your friends. We're not creating, maybe changing the landscape of the fan base in a bad way. Thinking about our game modes, a lot of the game modes that we had make a lot of sense when you bring in a second player. So we did existing with versus, and that was a lot of fun. And then can a player join mid-match? Yes, so we did the work. It's been a lot of tedious work to make sure that every system can catch up to the middle of the game. But it was worth it just to give people the flexibility. Or if someone drops out, you don't want to have to ruin the whole run. So this was our first ever playtest with Pip and Bits. I love this screenshot because it reminds me of like Power Rangers, just kind of like hanging out. And we had seven of us, and we jumped in. I think we were playing. The host was Luca's laptop on Wi-Fi in like a cafe or something terrible. And so we were just like stress testing it in the worst possible way. But it ended up just being chaos, and it was so much fun that it kind of changed our thought process around like the max number of players, because it ended up, even though certain things were easier, we were getting a lot more resources, we had so many more people to fight the monsters, it was more of a human problem. You know, so many people would be mining that no one would go back up and actually fight the monsters, and we would die. Or so you'd be collecting resources and someone would just go up and spend them all. And then you're like, oh, what are we doing? So it created a lot of really interesting challenges for ourselves. And I think it's definitely going to be a really fun way to play. So the challenges as we develop this, you know, how do you go from single player to multiplayer without breaking everything in the process? So how do we send the right data at the right time? Without rewriting the whole game. This is going to be really important. There's a lot of slides on this. Bandwidth optimization. So once we're sending the right data, how do we only send the amount of data that we need? Because the less bandwidth we use, the more players we can add, and it just makes it more accessible to a lot of players. How do we avoid writing our netcode three times? So we knew we wanted to do like local games. We knew we wanted to support Steam players playing together. And as we launch on consoles, we know we want to bring those people into the fold. But remember, all the stuff I'm talking about today is kind of more for porting an existing single-player game. I probably have different advice if you're building multiplayer from scratch, but there's still things to learn from this. So thinking about our system architecture, our clients have no idea where the host is when they first connect. The host doesn't actually know where the client is in their loading state when they first connect. And the thing to remember is when you have an offline game, every time you write a line of code, you have access to the data you need. Whether it's in that class or you have to go find a weird node somewhere to grab that data, the data is available. But that's just not true in an online network game. You don't have all that data. You may not even know you need that data. And so every time you approach rewriting functions or thinking about functionality, you kind of have to re-challenge every of those assumptions. So one example is the camera should center itself on like the local keeper when I first start the game. But if you're a client, your keeper doesn't exist when you connect. So you load the game, then you ask the host to make you a keeper. The host responds with all the data you need to spawn that keeper, and then you can center the camera. And that might only take like 1 or 2 milliseconds, but it's such an important 1 or 2 milliseconds, the game can crash, you can just have a bunch of errors in your debugger. And so you just have to rethink where you're waiting for data or what you're doing in the meantime. In addition, we can't actually assume that once a client's connected, they're ready to receive all the data you're trying to send them. So if I connect to an existing game, I'm in the middle of loading, but the host is trying to tell me about the map, the other client's trying to tell me about where their keeper is, and I'm just getting hundreds of errors. It's actually slowing down the game, or it ends up causing a crash. So being sure, like knowing where each client is in their process before you send them that data. So there's two approaches you can take in your game when thinking about when and how to send data to the clients. You can require all clients to connect in some sort of lobby phase, and then make sure everyone's ready, everyone says the go signal, and then only then you start sending data about like where people are, and you send all this reliably ordered so that the game stays in perfect sync. But even then, if you have a third client, it may load and tries to start sending data about its player to client two before client two has had a chance to load everything it needs to load. The other way is you can have each client kind of maintain like a connection state machine that says, here's where I am in the game flow, here's what I'm ready for. And each client will respect that when trying to do that. It's a lot more boilerplate, but it ends up being like much more sane to handle. And this is regardless of whether you're using like Godot's high-level multiplayer or using your build own multiplayer, just having that state machine that lets everyone know like what you're ready for. So when you send an RPC in Godot, if you're using Godot's high-level multiplayer, you have to have a node in the same path that has an RPC of the same name. It doesn't actually have to be the same type of node, but the path and the function name and the function arguments all have to match. And so if you're loading things dynamically, that node may not exist when you first send that RPC, and that's where you can get in a lot of trouble. You could send all of these RPCs through like a global singleton, but you're kind of ignoring the issue of you're sending data to someone who doesn't actually know what to do with it yet. So what we do is we have our clients report to both the host and every other client what their state is, what they're ready for. And so that way we know exactly where they are in the process and we can send them exactly what they need. We have different like spawn and sync stages. So if you have something that's dynamic, so if I load into the loadout, I'm ready to spawn the keepers, but I'm not necessarily ready to get all the keeper position data. So we kind of break those out into two different states. And same with like the level. I'm ready for the map. Okay, I'm ready for the keepers. Now give me everything else. So we use RPC exclusively. The reason I say that is because Godot has built-in nodes like the multiplayer synchronizer, the multiplayer spawner, that don't give you this level of control. They tap directly into the multiplayer connection. And so as soon as someone connects, they start trying to send data. You can kind of hold back the synchronizer by using like the visibility functionality, but it's not really what it's meant for. And then with the spawner, it's always going to want to send all of the nodes that it wants you to spawn as soon as you connect. So if you're not in the right scene or you're stuck on a loading page, all that data is going to come and just be forgotten. So again, if we have our own state machine, we use RPCs to kind of send that data and kind of control it a little bit better. And one thing I found as I've helped other people with their multiplayer projects is neither of these nodes are going to work if you're going full peer-to-peer. So your synchronizer packets will always get there before your spawner packets, unless you're routing them through the host. But if you're routing them all through the host, then you actually don't get any of the benefits of peer-to-peer. So we have our synchronizers. And what they do is they look at the target connection state. So they say, hey, here are the two states that I'm going to send data towards, and here's how often I'm going to send it, whether it's reliable, whether I periodically want to send like a full sync. So if it's a system that can get out of sync pretty easily, we might want to just send like a full catch-up packet every so often. Our synchronizers distinguish the first packet they send per client. So as someone new comes in, we send them a big catch-up packet, and then from then we kind of send them like more delta updates. And the synchronizer respects Godot's multiplayer authority. So there's certain cases where, like, you want to control your own keeper. Since we're a friendly kind of cooperative game, you can just tell us where your keeper is, and everyone else will respect that. And so that way we can say, keeper 2 is owned by client 2, and we just respect that. If you're doing more competitive stuff, well, a lot of times what you do is you'll send inputs, and the server will decide where you're at and send that back. But since we're more friendly, we can pass the authority back and forth. Bandwidth. So bandwidth is a fun one. How do you actually send the data you need across the network to have their simulation match your simulation? And when you're getting started, again, with an existing single-player game, you actually kind of already have this if you have a save system. So you've already figured out, here's the data I need to save so that when they load the game's back in the same state that it was. And you can use this as a really kind of like poor man's way of just getting multiplayer working. You just send the save state over with var to bytes. You read it and deserialize it on the other side and use that to set up your systems. And so you kind of have a matching starting point with both your server and your client. But once you get that initial state right, how do you keep things in sync going forward? So this kind of breaking down in three different ways. So you can send new states every frame or every time anything changes. You could send an RPC every time there's an event that could cause a change. Or the systems are actually deterministic and will stay in sync on their own, barring something crazy happening. And the answer is you probably use all of the above. It just depends on the system that you're working. But we'll go through all three. So with state synchronization, it's a super common networking technique, and it's actually required for anything that's non-deterministic, like physics in Godot. Even if you use a deterministic physics engine like Jolt, Its implementation in Godot is not deterministic or hasn't been proven to be deterministic. So you're almost always better off having the server simulate all the physics and just send these updates. But it's always a balance of bandwidth, interpolation, and prediction. Excuse me. But these kind of systems can kind of make or break your multiplayer experience. So these are typically unreliable packets sent with a fixed interval, so every physics frame. Too many conversations this week. So our first step is we want to be thoughtful about our bytes. We want to use something like packed byte array to give you the tools to create smaller packets. Oh my gosh, I cannot breathe right now. Sorry. So when you use packed byte array, it requires you to think about the different offsets. So how big is each byte? How big is this data that we're putting into the bytes? And can you introduce a lot of bugs? So we added something called packed byte stream, which will do all the offset math for you. And as long as you encode and decode in the same order, everything comes out great. Someone pointed out you could also use stream peer buffer. I don't like the API of that, but it kind of does similar things. But we liked adding custom functions on top of packed byte array, like encode vector 2, encode bool, that kind of does some of the backend math for you. Sometimes you need to go smaller than bytes. So you can go down to the bits. And Godot actually gives you all these sort of bitwise operations, so bit shifting, not, XOR, and you can use that computer science degree to pack tons of information into different integers. But that's terrible, and it looks like this. And it's super buggy, and it's unreadable, even if it is powerful. So we wrote a bit packed byte stream. And so it allows you to resize it, and allows you to pack different bits. So if you only need 9 bits for the size of your integer, you can just do that. Packing rotation, we know rotations, you know, from 0 to tau. We can just look at how many bits you want to use, divide that by that, and kind of turn it into an integer and back on the way out. And so using this, we're able to get down from, you know, from a naive dictionary down to this packed byte array is like saving like 70% from that to a bit packed, excuse me, half again. So you can get really small with the amount of data. The second way was responding to events. So when your game state only changes deterministically but based on user input, sending that RPC can trigger that event on everyone's simulation concurrently. So things like hitting tiles, using gadgets, upgrading your base, more of request response, kind of like HTTP using RPCs. But these are all reliable packets because the delivery is going to matter, unlike the state updates, which you'll just get the next one if you missed one. So deterministic systems, a lot of them could be, but aren't by default. So usually when our outcomes are primarily visual, we want to synchronize all these things based on RNG. But if we use something that everybody knows, like the monster idea is our seed, then we can just send the seed over and rely that the simulation will get the same thing. And since these are just visual, we can just send that and just save a ton of bandwidth because we don't need to simulate the monster on the host every frame and send that over. Our next challenge was deploying on 3 networks. So again, we want to do crossplay, Steam, and LAN. We want to support all 3 depending on how you're playing. Godot ships with the ENET multiplayer peer, which can handle all sort of LAN situations. We decided to build and open source a new Steam multiplayer peer. There were a couple out there, but they were kind of held back with some of the underlying libraries, and so we built a new one on top of that. And so once we had 2 out of 3 built into Godot using the multiplayer peer system, we decided to fully commit and create a crossplay peer that uses the PlayFab Party API. And so same thing, these multiplayer peers, all they need to do is send packets and make these connections. So you as a game developer can just think about what data you're sending. You don't have to think about necessarily how they're connecting and how those are getting there. So since the last time I gave this talk, I've had 6 months of working with QA and fixing bugs. And I thought it'd be interesting to look at, I went through every commit we've done in that time and thought about like, which kind of area we had to fix, what are the things that keep coming up. So I'm happy to report no reported bugs. It was really easy. We had nothing to do. No. We had 500, probably more. The QA team, Moral Fury, is very good. They know the game very well. They found some of the most insanely minor bugs, but they are bugs. They're things that worked before that didn't after we made a lot of these changes to these systems. And so it's been super helpful just to know that we can make these changes. We know that they're going to catch them, and we can get the game back to where it was, plus, you know, now with multiplayer. So a lot of these bugs, it's always the things you most expect. So we had eventually to add new systems to the game. The biggest one was versus mode. So completely game mode that didn't exist changed every data structure in the game because everything had to have a team now. So every drop, every gadget, every keeper, every dome. And it turns out that can be buggy. Secondary stations, so now you can create new stations, have a secondary weapon, these sort of things that just weren't in the game before, weren't as battle tested nearly as much as the rest of the game. A lot of the bugs were around there. We've had to create dozens of new UI screens, so as you're hosting a lobby, joining a lobby, if you're continuing a multiplayer game, like a local multiplayer game, you have to choose who's going to be what keeper. There's all these different UI screens, and those always come with bugs. And versus mode again, because it really, it was worth it. It's by far the best way to play, honestly. But it really did add a lot of things. And there's still some things that I'm not 100% sure we have right. And some of these surprised me. So, like, every sound in the game had to be changed in some way, because the game was built with a single keeper, a single screen, a single set of speakers in mind. And so many of those things just, like, are just built into so many assumptions. So as we started adding local multiplayer and you're having to like blend those sounds, Godot doesn't allow you to have multiple like audio listeners, so we have to think about how those sounds are going to play. Or just online, how much are you hearing from your friends, or how much are you hearing from the other dome? All these things had to be adjusted and tweaked. Local multiplayer input is kind of a nightmare. So if you just want to control two characters, if two controllers, works great. But if you have a game with UI, if you've never done UI with a controller in Godot, you have this concept of focus. And there's only one focused UI in the whole thing, doesn't matter how many viewports and controllers. So we had to start doing updates to the Godot core. So we pulled in a pull request that's been open for a while, but isn't maybe necessarily the right solution for everyone, but it looked perfect for us, which allowed you to have one focus per viewport and allowed us to tap into our input system and only send it to the right viewport. That got us most of the way there, but we still had to make more updates around when you actually move focus. Godot handles that really deep inside their input system, and they're really greedy about just saying, like, oh, someone hit right, everyone should move right. And so we just had to like start adding more concepts of like device ID to those sort of systems to really get it working. And again, I'm still not 100% sure this is going to be perfect. The hardest thing with network stuff, again, assuming we had the data when we need it, all these ordering issues, race conditions. Sometimes you write code, you're like, I'm going to have A come in, and then B is going to happen. And sometimes you get B, then A. You can write that code. But sometimes you get B three times, and then A. And sometimes A never shows up at all. And you just how networking works, unfortunately. And so you just have to adapt for that. And these sort of things are just going to keep coming up as we continue to play test with a broader audience. And getting those first states right. Now, there's a ton of issues we've had to fix around joining mid-game that we talked about, but even loading from a save. We've touched enough things, you know, back to versus mode with teams and, you know, things like that, where, like, when you load a game in, especially from, like, an older state, just making sure that everything gets put exactly where it needs to be. And honestly, fixing, like, a mid-game issue might break loading from a save, and then you have to go back and do it again. So lots of fun there. So what are some takeaways for you guys as you think about if you have this single player game, you want to make a multiplayer? What do I want you to remember from this talk? Define success up front. So again, not all multiplayer is the same. The early decisions that you make, that online, local, competitive, and co-op, that's how you limit the scope. That's how you can find true success. And not every game needs full online matchmaking for the I just want to play with my friend dream to come true. The best thing you can do is talk with your players, talk with your community, figure out what it actually is that they want to do, and do the least amount you can to get to that point. One thing I recently have been doing a lot of, so with my wife and kids, we've been playing a lot of co-op games. We've been playing Stardew, we've been playing Minecraft, playing Valheim. And you guys should really sit down with those games, like with two screens side by side, and play them to see like how in sync that they actually are. You know, or whatever games you like truly love to play multiplayer. Because I think you'll be shocked about like how perfect they actually are. I think we get into this state, especially when you're developing locally, you just have two screens, you want everything to be perfect all the time, and that's just not the case. And so using that to kind of set your benchmark can be really important. And you can use tools like Bandwidth to see how much data they're using to send back and forth, so you can help set benchmarks for games in your genre for how much bandwidth you should really be using. And you can use tools like Clumsy to like simulate like packet loss and latency. How do these games deal with these bad network situations? It might look kind of, you might think bad, but you probably never noticed when you're playing before. So knowing you'll never be perfect, think about what is going to be important to you. So most of our network updates are just triggering local visuals and sounds. It's making sure that the monster looks like it's getting hit when it's getting hit, making sure that the mining block explodes and releases the resources and things like that. Because the source of truth is always the host. We basically, there's one game state that matters, and that's your host, and we're just trying to give you as little information as we can to make sure that that shows up on the client. But yeah, it doesn't need to be perfect. And honestly, you can be even less perfect in a friendly situation by letting the client report their outcome. So in Domekeeper, if you have a laser and you're shooting a monster on your screen, but the host maybe thinks it's missing, you can just trust the client that they're hitting it. If they say they hit it and they say that it died, just let it die, because we made those decisions up front that like no one's going to cheat in your co-op game. And so that just makes your life a lot easier as you start to simulate these worlds. But again, it was only because we made those decisions up front. And then leverage the multiplayer peer system. I think it's, even if you don't want to use like the multiplayer synchronizer, the spawner, you know, just using an RPC and these multiplayer peers, it can give you so much flexibility. You write it in a network agnostic way, so that even if you decide to end up using W4 or any of these other like commercial things, or you just stick with Steam and ENET or WebRTC, all of these things, you can just swap them in and out really simply because you wrote everything with these multiplayer peers in mind. The biggest thing is, even if you know that 100% of your users are going to play on Steam, you want to be able to test with ENET. With Godot 4, you can launch two windows, have them connect to each other on ENET automatically with launch parameters, and both of them report to the debugger. So you can investigate both state in both remote trees, and it makes it so much easier to like find these weird sync issues. You can even use tools like Clumsy. So even if you're connected localhost to localhost, you can tell it, hey, add 200 milliseconds of latency, add dropped packets, and make sure that everything works to your liking. And so once you get to the end of that, then you only need to beg your friends one or two times to make sure that the Steam integration works. But if you do everything right, then it shouldn't matter whether it's ENET, Steam, or anything else. And understand whether the peers that you're looking at using are full peer-to-peer, because you probably won't want to use the vanilla nodes in that case. Ordering is hard, so I've talked about this a couple times. But more specifically, you can't, like, reliable packets are reliable that they come, not necessarily that they're going to get there before other packets that you sent. A reliable packet will always wait for the last reliable packet to be acknowledged. So if you send, like, hey, spawn this keeper reliably, which you want to do, but you send the, hey, my keeper's here unreliably, which you also want to do, they may show up out of order, and often you can almost guarantee that they will. So just write your code defensively so that you can actually handle those different kind of scenarios. You can also use higher level nodes, so things like monsters, tiles, drops. We kind of use these more higher level to say, hey, here's where this monster is. And if that client's like, I don't know about that one yet, it can just ignore it and move on. That way we don't have to have like that connection state machine have like 50 different states. But basically never assume you have all the data you actually expect to have unless it all comes together as like one big RPC call. And the most important thing is to stay scrappy. Like, don't actually rewrite your game for multiplayer. Like, you can get really far by taking advantage of that save serialization. You can get really far just by picking small numbers of systems to get started. Get back to playable. When we started Dome Keeper, we were hyper-focused on getting keepers moving and being able to mine. And we were able to do that in less than a week. And it was just really motivating for the team to see things move around and, like, the game just started to come together. You couldn't fight anything. You couldn't, like, you know, upgrade anything. But it just, we kept the game playable so you can come in and see where things were. Let the small stuff stay out of sync until, like, the last minute. I don't think we did the weather in Dome Keeper until, like, a couple months ago. It just, like, we've had open play tests for a while. No one noticed that the weather wasn't in sync. We did it because it's fun, but it didn't need to be. And once you solve the core issues, then you start expanding on the content, adding those additional systems, and keep growing from there. So thank you. I want to say thank you to the team at Bip and Bits for the opportunity to help them with this amazing game. And thank you for Austin and Jacob and the Rolf Fury QA team for all the help in making this a reality. Okay.
There's still quite some time for questions, so please raise your hand and ask.
Thanks for the talk. Yeah. One question I have is, did you consider balancing the game in a way when more keepers are connected, or did you just let it be and have it easier if more keepers are there?
Luckily, I get to pass that off back to the Rene. Yeah, there are definitely balance changes that are constantly happening in this situation. Like, one of the decisions we made early on was just to add a secondary, like, primary weapon. So in the lasers, you get two lasers. That's fun for laser, but when you have two artillery, the game actually gets, like, way too easy. And so I think there's going to be more balance changes happening throughout the playtest as we kind of balance it with, you know, the crazy hardcore prestige players are just going to always do great. But just finding that good balance for what's going to be fun and what's going to be maybe a little too overpowered. Yeah.
Another question?
You mentioned many times that you had QA team, and then you introduced a new bug while fixing other bug.
Yeah.
So have you had some unit tests or some other testing ways of how to keep everything else, like, working while fixing another bug besides the QA or some, like, the practices that you used or something?
Yeah. Had we come in and unit tests were already there, of course, that would be great. But I think for a project this size, it didn't make a ton of sense to spend months building those unit tests out, kind of thing. Because a lot of the bugs that we get from QA were things maybe we didn't even know were happening in the game. Like, I feel like an expert at the code base now, but excuse me, I definitely wasn't when I was building a lot of these features. So I think it was more important to, like, get into the iteration loop early and make sure the feel was right rather than worry about, like, very specific bugs, knowing we had a QA team and we had, you know, a great playtest community too. So.
All right. Yeah.
Hi, sorry. I joined like 10 minutes late, so I don't know if this was already covered, but, like, I'm not sure I understand, like, correctly the architecture of the multiplayer, like, multiplayer architecture. Is it peer-to-peer? Is there an, like...
It's all peer-to-peer.
But there's a host.
Yeah, there'll be one host. One player is the host.
And can be, like, there'll be a dedicated, like, server. There's, it have to be a player.
You'll have to be a player. Yeah, there'll be no servers.
Right. And I suppose, like, the Steam multiplayer is, like, just like hole punching slash tunneling?
So we use Steam, they're called Steam networking sockets. And so basically it'll run through the Steam's relay server so that you don't have to, like, open ports or anything like that.
Does it also do net punching, if you know, net hole punching, if you know that?
It's too unreliable, I think, for a lot of games, especially just, like, no one wants to open a port. And unfortunately it's like 50% of the time that, like, net punching and all that stuff doesn't work. I know some people have done, like, stun and, you know, turn things, and using WebRTC to, like, find that open path. But all of our players right now are on Steam, and so they provide this great thing for us. And then we have a good partnership with, like, Microsoft and PlayFab to be able to, like, leverage that for the cross-play.
So always relay.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Okay, in the back.
I'm wondering, I imagine that a lot of the changes you did also, you had to make changes that affect like the local nodes, mm-hmm. or like changes that might affect the non-multiplayer stuff. So yeah. Did you use any design patterns to clearly differentiate between these two, or how did you kind of avoid regressions in the non-multiplayer code base?
No, we made a conscious decision to not completely separate out the single player code. We had talked about that early on of like, we're afraid to touch it. We don't want to break things. But we got guidance from Pip and Bits, like, no break things. Like, we have this fantastic QA team. Like, this is where they're here from. They'll find it, promise. So it simplified our lives a little bit easier. So a lot of the stuff was battle tested, both in single player playtesting and in multiplayer. So yeah, good question.
Hi, thanks for your talk. I wanted to ask about the Steam multiplayer peer implementation that you talked about. Could you talk about what drove you to write your own as opposed to using something like Godot Steam? Were there any specific constraints that you wanted to implement, or was it just not at the state where it was usable for you?
So we wrote our own, but we gave it back to Godot Steam. And made it Gramps' problem. So what's nice about that is we're able to leverage all the bindings that he's already done on them. But like the peer itself is written in C++, so we're actually talking to Steam's API directly. But yeah, we had written our PlayFab multiplayer peer and got really opinionated on how these peers should work and things like that. And so we wanted to disconnect the Steam lobby system from the actual netcode peer. And so what's nice is we can able to now, you can handle your own lobbies, or if you don't want to use Steam lobbies, you can just connect people directly and leverage that with the new peer. So, yeah.
He asked my question, but I'm here from Columbus, Ohio, so I'll just say go Buckeyes and thanks for the talk.
All right, do we have another question here?
So you showed us some of the tools that you use to reduce bandwidth. Do you have some sort of metric that you can tell us how much work it actually was and which bandwidth you were able to reach or had to reach to make your game playable on such bad conditions in a cafe, for example?
I don't have hard numbers. Like the biggest thing I was worried about is when... In Domekeeper, when you're carrying like iron and cobalt and things like that, all of those are physics bodies, and so that's all being simulated. And so we need to send those packets as often as possible. We can try and do some prediction or interpolation, but it just starts to feel bad after a certain point. So the best way we could do is just send less data. And so originally, I'm trying to think if I can remember the numbers, but I know that from our naive implementation of that, just to using the packed byte array and packed byte stream. It went down by at least 60 or 70%, and then it was a whole other half when we did to the bit pack. But I want to say it's like 4 kilobytes per physics body per second. So if you have someone carrying around 30 things and you're connected to 7 peers, like they can really get out of control really quickly. And the more people you have, the more likely someone's carrying around 30 things. So yeah, it kind of gets exponential. So there's probably still more work to be done there if we can. Or maybe at a certain level of player count, we just start sending those updates less and less. And so that'll just be part of when you have a big team, it's going to feel a little worse. So, or make them non-physics objects, but that's less fun. So, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for the talk. I was curious about the GD script and the C++. You've mentioned in the beginning most of the code being in GD script.
Yeah.
What about C++? And have you chosen C++ just for the usability, or performance was also an issue?
So some of the like the multiplayer peers, I actually don't know if you can write those in GDScript. But just for like, it was part of an engine module, so we just wanted to build it directly into the engine. And we had the C++ expertise on the team, but we didn't move any of like the major core systems from GDScript and C++. Almost every gameplay element is still GDScript. But we just wanted to move all the network code just to be aligned with like the ENET stuff, and that's all in C++. So, yeah.
I don't know. What's the worst network condition you've seen the game run smoothly on?
Honestly, the video that I showed was pretty bad. I don't know if we'll be able to get back to it fast. But yeah, that was like on a laptop. I was in the United States. We were playing from Europe over Wi-Fi. Someone might have been on a mobile cell phone. I'm not even sure. But yeah, so like you could see a couple times where, like, again, this was very early back in February, but you can definitely see like where we're having to interpolate and it'll catch up and kind of do things like that. But we've locally, when we do like use Clumsy, we'll go to the extremes and say 50% packet loss in, you know, 1 second. And it feels bad. Like, of course it's going to, but ideally those network conditions happen for an instant and then kind of come back. At a certain point, if you just don't have a good network, you're just not going to have a good time playing a real time game. So, yeah.
Is there a question left?
Oh, yeah. Hi. So I've worked in a studio where we focused on multiplayer games, co-op game most recently, and a lot of the things you said are very familiar, so basically same decisions also, lots of them. So you mentioned in the beginning you might do some things different if you wouldn't basically add it to an existing game, but design it from the beginning that way. So what would that be then?
I think there's a lot of ways you can design some of that first like flow around like the data structures that you have in place around multiple keepers or like multiple players and how that interacts. Because we were adapting a single player game, we always defaulted to like just send it all to the host and they'll tell you what should be happening. But I think you could do like the RPCs in Godot, there's a state called call local where it allows them to like also run code simultaneously. And so I think if we had designed this from the start as multiplayer, a lot of these systems would be more deterministic out the gate. So they could just try and simulate everything local and just have every once in a while have like a catch-up system or something like that. And so really it was just trying to like meet the game where it was and just trying to make the simulation match on both sides. But I think if I was designing from the beginning, a lot of these systems I would just approach less so about like, oh, just tack on like synchronization at the end. Like when I'm designing for our multiplayer game at our studio, I'll design a system with single player in mind just to get the game feel right, just to make sure that it's actually fun. And then I usually throw all of that out and then just rethink everything at that point. But it's at the very beginning, so it's a lot easier to do. Yeah, thanks.
Is there any question left?
One more in the back.
In the back?
Just a very obvious one. Have you thought about adding voice over IP into the game networking?
We talked about it. That's actually something that you can get for free with PlayFab and crossplay. But it ended up just not being important for the team. We just figured most players are going to be in Discord anyway. So, yeah.
Yeah. How often do you have to synchronize the world like in the game? Can you also need to like synchronize the block destruction and recreation?
Yeah, so our keepers and our resources were updating every physics frame, so 60 times a second. Everything else is, I think everything else is either deterministic or just by RPC, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, can you need to like resynchronize it like mid-game?
Oh, yeah. Often? We've started doing that more often as we, some of those poor network conditions, even the deterministic stuff can start to fall behind. Actually, it's less network condition and more low FPS. So if a game is just like running on a weaker computer, it may not keep up with that. And so we've started to add those like periodic full synchronizations. And it'd be anywhere from every 3 to 10 seconds. That's usually enough to keep up with that. Yeah, good question.
A final question.
Great talk, thank you. Did you have any issues with maximum packet sizes? So synchronizing lots of objects, did you do any fragmentation, etc.?
The only time we ever ran into issues is sending the map data during the loading screen to make sure you can simulate. So rather than rely on deterministic procedural generation on the map data, we just let the host generate the map and then send it over. That one, luckily, we didn't have packet size consideration for ENET or even PlayFab, but Steam, we were hitting that like 500 kilobyte limit. But just adding stronger compression was even on our biggest map, we were able to get below that. We had played around with breaking those packets up a little more, but it ended up being overkill, so we just stuck with compression.
All right, then please give another round of applause.